Right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? Is this mic turned on?
Yes.
Right. My name's Christopher Hill of the International Relations Department. It's my pleasure to welcome you here for this special event which the department is putting on the September the 11th crisis and its implications. We try not to pretend that we live in an ivory tower in the department, indeed in the LSE in general, as you know. It's applied social science. Even when we do theory, we want the theory to have some meaning to our daily lives, and many of us are engaged in one way or another in important political issues. And this is one of the most important and serious political crises that we could be involved in, however indirectly. We're living through a major international crisis, whether it's the biggest since the Cuban Missile Crisis, no one will know until further events have transpired, but it's certainly an extremely serious one, and all of us are extremely concerned about it. But we take the view in this department, or many of us do, that we need to try to throw some light on events in a way which goes beyond the things that you can read in the newspapers and see on television, as useful and important as those are. They're our only source of information at first hand, and which goes beyond a kind of polemical political meeting, which are also important. Politics has to exist domestically, and we need a vibrant discussion of the great choices that are at stake. But the purpose this evening, in the limited time we have available, is to try to use some of the work that's been done over many years now in the subject of international relations, which started after the First World War as an attempt scientifically to try to create or understand the conditions in which peace might be created and justice achieved without unnecessary conflict. And so we have 80 years or more of work in this area, and we think that many parts of it can help us to understand the difficult circumstance in which we find ourselves in. And I'm very grateful to my colleagues here, mostly from the International Relations Department, but not entirely, who have agreed to take part in this session. They're going to speak very briefly for about 7 minutes each, or at least I'm going to try to control them in that process. And then we're going to open it up for questions. And I promise you, we will try not to be too long-winded and try to have a period in which we can engage with questions from the floor. I'm going to introduce them not in the order of play, but from my right, so that you can get a sight of who they are and identify them. You will know many of them already. Professor William Wallace on the far right is going to talk about European, not his accustomed position, it has to be said, is going to be talking about European views and dilemmas. Professor Chris Brown is going to give some reflections on the ethical issues at stake. Here we have another good colleague, but not from this department, from the equally distinguished Department of International Politics, the University of Wales, Aberystwyth, Professor Michael Cox, who is going to talk about the issue of US hegemony. On my left, many of you, those of you who do foreign policy analysis, won't need introducing Professor Margot Light, who is going to talk about lessons from the past, that, which as many of you do, FPA will know, is an important part of that course as applied to this particular crisis. On her left, we have visiting professor James Rubin. Many of you will also know from appearances on TV, but also because he gave a course last year on US foreign policy, which I think he's repeating this year. He was a spokesman in the last American administration, and also deeply interested in the process of American foreign policy making. He's going to talk about US foreign policy with specific reference to the domestic dimension in the current crisis. And on the far left, we have Dr. Caterina Dalla Cura, who is going to talk about September the 11th and Islam, which is a part of her area of expertise. And in fact, Dr. Dalla Cura is going to kick off for us, and I'll ask her again to try and stick to 6 or 7 minutes, and then I will follow in sequence after that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is this working?
Yeah.
In the 5 minutes, 6 minutes that I have, I want to address a question which I think has been paramount on people's minds since September the 11th. On many people's minds, definitely on my mind. This is the question of whether there is something special or particular about Islam which has led to the perpetration of these awful crimes by a group of Muslims. Now, my answer to this question is both yes and no. There is plenty, in my view, in the religion of Islam which can be drawn upon to justify violent terrorist activity. And Islamic fundamentalists throughout this century, if not before, have actually done that, have drawn on religious principles to justify violence and terror. Examples of these principles and how they've been interpreted in this way include a very hardline, extremist, intolerant interpretation of jihad, the notion of holy war in Islam. A division of the world into the world of Islam and the world of war, beyond the domain beyond Islam. And contempt for non-Islamic, secular world principles and the lax morals that could go with these principles. Historical examples, real application of this extremist interpretation of Islam, have included, for those of you who have followed these things a little bit, the conduct of extremist groups, hardline Islamists, in the Algerian Civil War since 1992, which has seen horrific violence being perpetrated very often against defenseless people. The war of Arab and North in Sudan against non-Muslim South, and the terrorist activities of extremist Islamist groups in Egypt, which you may have heard about or read about in the newspapers in recent years. On the other hand, we can see that the principles of this religion can be and have been in the politics of the Middle East be interpreted in a very, very different way to the one I've just described. In a world of nation states, which is one of our subjects today, Islam, and specifically jihad, has been mostly interpreted in a defensive way. So it is more useful, I think, to talk about religious nationalism rather than the application of Islam in war and the politics of the Middle East. I'll give you a few examples. In the war against Iraq, the Iranian leadership between 1980 and 1988 talked about the defense of the faith, but also about the defense of the homeland of Iran. And there was a very gray area between the two. Hamas and Hezbollah are engaged in a war for Palestine and Lebanon, respectively, and are therefore concerned with the liberation of their nation as well as with propagating the Islamic religion. And their terrorist activities they have tried to justify in a roundabout way in the discourse of the leadership of Hamas and Hezbollah, again as a defense against enemies from outside. The Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the major Islamist organization in the Middle East, spoke in May 2001 about Palestinian suicide bombers against Israelis and said that suicide bombers who carried out attacks against civilians could not be considered martyrs, could not be considered martyrs. And I don't know if you read carefully the statement that it was made by bin Laden in the video that he gave to Al Jazeera television immediately after the event. But in that statement, he mentioned Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the nuclear bombing by the United States of these two cities in 1945, therefore showing that he understands very well what it means to bomb civilians, and he described this as a crime. Therefore, I believe that to understand the causes of September the 11th, it is necessary but not sufficient by any means to focus on Islam and the religion of Islam and its principles, because these principles can be interpreted in such widely divergent ways, and we've seen that in the politics of the region. Now, it's not possible to know what the various publics of Middle Eastern states are thinking, either about the September the 11th or about the intervention in Afghanistan, simply because there is no statistics, there are no polling stations that can conduct and measure public opinion in most of these countries. But my belief is that the publics in their majority in the Middle East are caught between a rock and a hard place. I have no doubt that the majority of people in the Middle East have found September the 11th an atrocious crime, like everybody else has. But on the other hand, there's long-running suspicion and hostility against the United States. So it's really that they're caught in the middle, and this is my reading of the situation. Many of the clues about what happened on September the 11th can be found, I believe, in the politics, economics, and social developments of the specific Middle Eastern states. And despite the very strong transnational element in Islam, the financial side of which we've seen quite a lot of, or read about quite a lot of, I think that the state system remains alive and well in the Middle East, and that it defines politics in a very real way. I think that Bin Laden and the interpretation of Islam that he proposes, that he propagates, is very much a product of Saudi politics and Saudi society. And this is where we should be looking at if we want to understand a lot about what is going on. Not an easy thing, given the closed nature of Saudi society. But I think that it is the Saudi regime which has perpetrated, to a large extent, the kind of Islam throughout the region and beyond the region that has been now sort of committing these horrible crimes. So, of course, Bin Laden is against the Saudi regime, but he's also very much a product of Saudi society. We also need to look at United States policy in the Middle East, because that, of course, has also been behind a lot of what has happened. This is not to justify the crime of September the 11th. It's simply to say that it is now long overdue that a reassessment of US foreign policy is conducted. But I'll leave that to others.
Thank you very much, Katerina. Very clear, helpful. I'm now going to ask Professor Michael Cox to talk about, as I said, US hegemony.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I just, in a way, I want to sort of say briefly something about the question of US hegemony very, very quickly at the beginning, and then maybe try and make a few reflective points. And I suppose my reflective points could come under the question or question mark, whatever happened to progressive politics. And I really want to sort of maybe make some observations about what all this means for broad progressive politics in the world today, because I think in many respects I think September the 11th is a deeply depressing not only an act in itself, but the consequence itself have almost, in my view, been wholly deleterious for a larger progressive agenda, however we want to define that. And then maybe say some things at the end. So firstly, on the question then of US hegemony. There's no question the 1990s was a period of huge resurgence for the United States, both in economic terms, in terms of military spending, in terms of the inability of others to define international politics in any particularly important way, particularly Europe, and many, many other aspects of it. In short, I mean, the 1990s was a period in which, whereas in the 1980s people have been talking about American decline, the United States in retreat, and the United States is in a pax hegemonic position, the 1990s was clearly a period of a resurgence. And in that respect, one can therefore say that what happened on September the 11th is the most direct and frontal attack on it. And in some ways, one can say that September the 11th happened in part, because of the very overwhelming hegemony of the United States. It wasn't the only factor. There were many other factors involved in the motivation and the calculations of those who did what they did on September the 11th. But in some sense, it was a very direct and brutal and bloody and ruthless statement about the very character of the world in which we happen to live, in which the United States was overwhelmingly powerful. At the same time, my argument is, and this in some senses says something about the paradox of September the 11th, that everything that has happened thus far, and I think will continue into the future, will not only have the reverse effect to that which the perpetrators of September the 11th wanted, but will lead actually over the weeks and months ahead, I think, to a far stronger US hegemony. So in that sense, if the purpose of September the 11th, or one of the purposes of September the 11th, was to undercut, destroy, weaken the United States, then I think in that particular respect, if one is thinking of September the 11th as a rational act, then it has not only failed, but will have actually the reverse consequences, as has often happened in history in the past. The creation of a major coalition, which was almost unthinkable before, the reunification of America around some pretty fundamental values over the last few weeks, this is not a state which is about to go under, and not a state which is about to retreat. Indeed, if I had given the same lecture on American foreign policy before September the 11th, what I would have talked about was how actually the first 6 months of the Bush presidency was weakening the United States through its unilateralist policies. And effectively what September the 11th has done has had quite the opposite effect on America and indeed on many aspects of the Bush foreign policy. Those are the observations I want to make briefly on US hegemony. Let me then just turn quickly then to the second part. We all respond to this politically. We don't just respond to it in an academic way. We all respond to this in a political way. And I want to make some part of my comments in a sense political, although I hope not too provocative. And I want to put that from the point of view of somebody who has clearly over many years been identified with the larger progressive politics in this country and elsewhere, and why I find September the 11th really quite depressing. First, there's the act itself, an act of mass murder, and it shouldn't be called anything else. Then we have the response, which in some sense is perfectly understandable, but one has to wonder what the aims of the war are, where this war is going, and what the objectives and outcome are going to be. More worrying, however, I think has been some of the responses around the world. I think from a progressive point of view, one, I think, has to be deeply worried, deeply concerned, and in some sense deeply depressed about the apparent popularity in many parts of the world of Osama bin Laden. I find the attempt to draw analogies between Osama bin Laden and Che Guevara not only historically odd, but actually strange and deeply misleading. Well, whatever one might have thought about Che, and I thought a great deal about him, Che, after all, was trying to lead a progressive movement in Latin America. I do not see this coming out of the ideology or the statements of Osama bin Laden, who seems to think it perfectly legitimate to kill innocent people, support a regime which oppresses women, and to establish totalitarian theocracies throughout the Middle East. If that is progressive, then what that definition of progressive, it strikes me as being peculiar. I'd also have to say something about the left in general, which I clearly identify myself and have no problems identifying myself. The Cold War has not had that much of an effect on me. I do find it disturbing, worrying, depressing to find that many of my old comrades and friends seem to have lost their moral compass over the last few weeks, who in some senses seem to hold the United States more culpable for what happened on September the 11th than the perpetrators themselves. I do find that deeply depressing, worrying, and concerning, as if all the problems of the world arise from the United States and to blame the United States itself. It is easy, it is the easy way out, it is the easy exit strategy, it is the easy political answer, but I don't think it provides us with much political guidance today. I find it also worrying some of the things which are happening inside the United States. Patriotism, but a patriotism without any questions. Not a stifling of dissent, but concerns about should one be a dissident in the United States at the moment. Some attacks on civil liberties. Some sections of this particular administration have, I think, used the crisis occasioned by September the 11th to pass and to think about some very worrying legislation in the United States. And I find it deeply worrying that people are talking openly and without any worry about unleashing the CIA assassinations of foreign leaders. What I also find worrying, and I suppose depressing, is where we were before September the 11th. Where we were before September the 11th was in a large debate about globalization. That's where we were before September the 11th. We were talking about the politics of redistribution, the politics of wealth, the politics of what happens in countries, the distribution of the benefits of this larger capitalist system, which we call the global economy. All that debate has been driven off the agenda. I don't think it's so surprising, of course, immediately after what happened on September the 11th, those who were organising anti-globalisation demonstrations simply cancelled them. That doesn't mean to say that I identify with all the questions and all the answers provided by the anti-globalisation people. Many of the questions I think they pose wrongly, and many of the answers they come up with I think are incorrect. But nevertheless, there was a large, progressive, broad agenda which was there, where discussion could take place in open debate, and I think that has been pushed further and further. And finally, what I find quite depressing, in a sense, we are not exactly in a Cold War, but we're in a Cold War in one very obvious sense. We are being forced to make simple choices. We're back into two-camp politics, where we're either for the United States or against the United States, or in some senses identify with the peoples of the Middle East, or with Islam, or with radical Islamic fundamentalists, or whatever. This is the problem for me, that we have to find some way of getting beyond that type of narrow definition. Just finally, 2 points, Chris, and I'll conclude. Has anything good, or could anything good come out of this? Could anything good come out of this? Well, in some senses, two things could, and one thing already has. The Northern Ireland peace process has been back on track precisely because of September the 11th. There would not have been decommissioning by provisionals without September the 11th. This has made a huge impact. And I think in that sense something good has come out of it. And secondly, and perhaps in the end we might say that all roads will lead, not to Damascus, but all roads may lead to Jerusalem. Clearly this brings major pressure, it seems to me, to bear back on the United States and its policies on Israel and what it does in Israel. And hopefully, if anything good comes out of this, if that particular question and set of questions can be raised again, then at least something good will come out of this disaster.
Thank you very much, Mick. Now let's move on to Professor Margot Light, who is going to be talking about the lessons of history for this conduct of this crisis.
At a time when opponents of the war are called appeasers, or to quote Polly Toynbee in The Guardian today, morally decrepit, let me preface my remarks by stating unambiguously that I'm opposed to terrorism, that I abhor the use of violence against innocent civilians, and that I believe that the events of 11th of September were a terrible tragedy. Similarly, I hold no brief for the Taliban, not as a government and not as a movement, and not just for its treatment of people of my gender. That said, I want to make three pragmatic arguments against the present use of military force against terrorism: the intervention in Afghanistan, and the declaration of a war to eliminate terrorism. My first two arguments are based on the lessons of history. This is a term commonly used in foreign policy analysis, where much of the discussion is about the problem of decision makers learning the wrong lessons of history. But there is an equally strong argument to be made against refusing to learn the lessons of history. The lesson that history teaches us about using massive military force against terrorists is that it tends to create more terrorism. There are many, many cases where this has been the result. Two current examples serve to illustrate. Israel's use of military force against terrorists has not eliminated terrorism. In fact, there is every chance that it is simply increasing the number of people who are prepared to support them. Russia's use of military force against Chechnya in the first war in 1994 to 1996 created many of the rebels who were fighting against Russia in the second war. And Russia's use of massive military force against Chechnya in this second war has turned many peaceful Chechens into rebel supporters. there is every reason to suppose that the current use of military force against terrorism will, in the same way, create more terrorists than it destroys. The second argument about the lessons of history pertains to Afghanistan. The Soviet intervention in Afghanistan turned many opponents of the insurgents into opponents of the Soviet Union. This should not have come as a surprise to the Soviet leadership. Foreign invaders frequently find that the people that they have come to save turn into their enemies. There is no reason to suppose that this will not happen again as a result of foreign intervention in Afghanistan. The Soviet experience and the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan produces another lesson. The coalition that formed against the Soviet Union did not long survive the Soviet withdrawal. The Northern Alliance, or coalition government sponsored by the anti-terrorist coalition, is likely to suffer the same fate unless it is supported by a prolonged military presence. Again, this should come as no surprise. There are other examples in Europe at the moment where the same case pertains. My third pragmatic argument concerns the aim of a war to eliminate terrorism. And this time, I base myself on von Clausewitz and his strategic theory. Von Clausewitz points out that wars are fought for political aims. They can only be won if the aim of the war is achievable. We will have no way of knowing whether we have achieved the goal of eliminating terrorism. So there will be no way to declare with honor that we have won the war. A war to eliminate terrorism is a war without end. I accept the argument that many make that after the 11th of September, something had to be done. This does not mean, however, that what should be done is a policy that carries such a high probability of exacerbating the condition it is aimed to cure.
Thank you very much, Marga. Not least for being so concise, 5 minutes, I think. Now, Professor James Rubin, who knows US foreign policy making from the inside. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to minimize the discussion of why the current military campaign is the only course that the administration could have chosen, because that wasn't what I was asked to talk about, and you've probably heard a lot of reasons for that, and we can bring that up in the questions and answers. Suffice it to say that in all the discussions I've heard here in London, even those in the past few minutes, nobody has offered me an alternative way of ensuring that the events of September 11th wouldn't be repeated in far, far worse form. Some have talked about a law enforcement model that we should do in Afghanistan, what was done to Libya, keep sanctions on for 7, 8, 9 years, and then eventually they will cough up the so-called terrorists. Others have talked about the United States changing its policies in the Middle East or vis-a-vis Saudi Arabian protection of the Saudi Arabian government. And those things are just simply not going to happen as a result of the United States being attacked in the way it was. So we'll have more time to talk about what the right course is. Let me give you a little bit, for those of you who are Americans, I don't think what I will say will be a surprise, but for those of you who are not, maybe a little bit of a flavor of what the calculations are in Washington, what the mood is, and why I believe that the United States will be able to sustain a willingness to fight in Afghanistan for the long haul. We've heard some of these comparisons before, but when you're talking about an issue like this, you need to go back to the beginning. And the beginning is, what did happen on September 11th? What happened was that the United States, continental the United States, was attacked for the first time since, I guess, the War of 1812 with the British. Pearl Harbor occurred in the middle of an ocean. It was a military installation, and the casualties were far, far fewer. So those of you who understand the psychological and military and political significance of Pearl Harbor, you should, whatever level you assign to that, you should increase it, because this was the United States homeland, and it was innocent men, women, and children who were killed. Secondly, it's worth remembering what is it that was attacked. New York City is not just the home of global capitalism, if you believe that, but it's also the, in a sense, the symbolic home of all the people in the United States who came here as immigrants or came there as immigrants. These towers, behind them stood the Statue of Liberty. And this attack was on the most fundamental institutions of the United States, and people will not easily forget that either. So to understand why the United States might be behaving the way it is, you really need to sit back and not just look at the picture today in Afghanistan of innocent civilians who may or may not have been hit by American military bombs, but to think about what has motivated the United States to go so many thousands of miles away from its home, and what happened on September 11th. Domestically, I think it's fair to say I am never witnessed a convergence of opinion politically in the United States as that which occurred following September 11th. There is no serious question that the United States needs to do everything in its power to prevent the events of September 11th from recurring, recurring, and recurring in a far more dangerous or potentially more fatal form. There is only one member of Congress who voted against the resolutions. She wasn't pilloried, she wasn't attacked, she didn't have tomatoes thrown at her. She's probably going to be reelected. She is the only one who made that decision, and the rest of Congress voted for authorizing the president to take whatever steps necessary to respond to those who committed those attacks. That is unprecedented. And you can reach back in history and find times in which the United States has voted that way, but we've learned from those events. Just think about all the Democrats and Republicans who lived through Vietnam, who knew what the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was, the blank check they could potentially be offering the President of the United States, and they still did it because they understood that this wasn't a fight over who and what ideology should control the country of Vietnam, or how many innocent people were dying in Somalia or Bosnia, or the Gulf War, which took place thousands and thousands of miles away. This was the ultimate defense of the United States homeland. My favorite example of this is, I know some of you are probably a little young to remember this, in the late 60s there was a famous trial called the Chicago 7 trial, and these were the so-called hippies and yippies of that generation. A lawyer for that group, who remains a prominent fixture in the left in the United States, he said publicly, he said, well, I was against Vietnam. I was against every use of force by the United States since the time he matured politically, because I always said that I would only be for using military force when they attacked our homeland. And now that is what they have done, and we need to respond accordingly. So that is the political spectrum. There is no debate and on the question of whether the United States should respond militarily to what happened on September 11th. There may be discussions about what the best tactic is, ground forces, air forces, special forces, covert operations, assassinations, but there is no debate because what the American people learned is how vulnerable they are, how much so many people in the world hate the United States, and therefore how important it is to defend the United States. Mick has discussed a little bit about the silver linings, and I think he's quite right to do so. For me, the silver linings are quite clear. We sit here in London. Just a few months ago, people were concerned that the United States was turning into a unilateralist global cowboy. That era is over. From here to here forward, every time an issue arises, whether it be missile defense, the Middle East peace process, relations with China, the India-Pakistan dispute. That will be decided within the prism of, will this be good or bad for the coalition against terrorism, a coalition which requires cooperation in the law enforcement area, in the intelligence area, in the military sphere, overfly rights, potential search and rescue missions, financial sanctions, economic sanctions. And that is the prism through which America's foreign policy will now be viewed for many, many years to come. And that doesn't lend itself to the fears of unilateralism that some people had. Another silver lining, I think, domestically in the United States is the American people now are very, very focused on what goes on outside the world, outside of the United States and the rest of the world. They're very focused on what causes so many people to stand up and cheer and be pleased when so many thousands of innocent people are killed. And they're focused on that subject. And domestically, it's a remarkable thing that this president has used the words that were so anathema to him during the campaign and in his first 9 months in office, and that is that he wants to work with the United Nations to do nation building. I was part of an administration that was pilloried by people like George W. Bush for even considering the actions in Somalia or pursuing the conflict in Bosnia and Kosovo on behalf of innocent people on the grounds that this was the work of do-gooders and this was not the business of the United States. Well, he has now committed our country for the long term to the reconstruction, redevelopment of legitimate government in Afghanistan and the reconstruction and rebuilding of the limited infrastructure that they had. That is a remarkable commitment. It's not something that's going to go away when this conflict is over. And let me make the final point, which is one of the reasons why there's no debate in the United States is because he did a remarkably good job in putting a coalition together. There would have been elites in the foreign policy community who would have looked askance at this had it not been that China, Russia, all the NATO countries, India, Pakistan, there has never been a conflict in the modern era in which all of those countries have supported the United States or any country in military action. There is a reason for that, because all the civilized countries from all religions and all parts of the world recognize that what happened on September 11th was a violation of everything that the world order requires and requires a response. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Jamie, for that authentic perspective. We're now going to get the view from the authentic American expert.
Outside the world.
I was getting ahead of myself there. I'm aware that William Wallace is going to talk about the European perspective, which, of course, should be perspectives and probably overlaps a lot with the Europeans. But to avoid getting into deeper waters, I will hand straight over to Professor Wallace.
Good idea. Two rapid additions to what Jamie said. If you're reading the American press at the moment and you see the attacks from the right on what George Bush is doing, you recognize what a good job Bush is doing and how much better he has actually managed the conflict so far than many of us would ever have anticipated. And if you really want to see what the alternative is, just read William Safire from time to time and it will make your hair stand on end. Secondly, there's a real problem for the United States in that the United States has invested very heavily in high technology weaponry. And it has an ability to project power at the high end for fighting major wars at immense speed. Three aircraft carrier task forces out there in the Indian Ocean without very much to do. And that's part of the problem. And what I want to say really is from the European perspective, we're actually talking about containment rather than war. The Europeans have a very odd perspective on this in some ways because European governments feel semi-detached. The shock in the United States is for the first time to have a threat to the homeland. I was sitting in a conference in Boston about 5 months ago, listening to people talk about homeland defence, and several of us eventually said, you don't begin to understand what this concept means. We've been sitting with people bombing buildings in our cities for the last 30 years. We've got used to it, we understand the problems, and we've managed the risk. The United States is now going to have to go socially through a whole set of adjustments to living at a level of risk which European states have been managing ever since I was a student. But part of the sense of semi-detachment in Europe is not only that we've been through quite a lot of this already. Indeed, the terrorism against the United States in the 1960s and 1970s mostly took place on European soil, including the Libyan missile attack on southern Italy in Lampedusa. But it's also that the European approach, ex-imperial powers, has moved towards one in which peacemaking, peacekeeping, diplomacy, nation-building are much more the normal approach. We don't have the high-technology weaponry. We also recognize we can't disengage. We have our own very substantial Muslim populations, by and large, well-integrated into our societies. We are close to North Africa, close to the Middle East, so we can't disengage. But there's also a sense in which we're no longer the hegemon, so we can look at the United States and think, and are tempted sometimes to say, ha ha. Let me just make an obvious comparison. 100 years ago, when the British were global hegemons, the British got into a war in Southern Africa. It was a war that the British should never have got into. There were a number of mistakes that had been made over the previous 10 to 15 years. The British were too concerned about diamonds in the way in which I think the Americans have been too concerned about oil. But one way or another, they slipped into the Boer War. And not only in Germany, but also in France and Italy, there was a lot of quiet happiness at the hegemon being brought down a peg or two before they realized that actually having a liberal power in charge was quite a good thing. We make some other historical parallels there, because if you think about the situation 100 years ago, what you actually had was a number of states which were highly unstable because they were halfway through the modernization revolution. They were going through population explosions, people moving from the villages into the towns, so moving from traditional religious and communal life into secular mass movements, being radicalized, and population explosion also implied pretty good mass emigration. So there was social revolution happening in a number of countries, and empires which, to save themselves from falling apart, were doing their best to be aggressive. Think of the way in which Turkey, Russia, Austria-Hungary eventually collapsed from internal tensions in the process of modernization. Now, that's partly how I think one has to look at the problems of West and Central Asia at the present moment. Iran, where the United States immensely overinvested in the Shah's regime, went through a revolution which was intended, of course, to bring sweetness and light, but actually for some years brought something which was much worse. Well, that's not new either. Look at the intense enthusiasm of 1789 to 1790 and how awful the French Revolution was 5 years later. And one can anticipate, similarly on a broad historical perspective, that the Saudi regime, which is deeply traditional in the way it legitimizes itself, must eventually collapse, and that the successor regime will immediately be worse before it gets through the transition to a more modern, secular, open society. European perspectives on this, by and large, particularly if you take Prime Minister Blair's immensely ambitious speech the other week, are that we ought to help these societies through the process of transition. And we somehow got to help them move from unstable societies and authoritarian states to move towards the sort of thing we want. We're into nation building, and we'll stop Rwanda, Burundi happening again, and we'll help not only in Sierra Leone, but if necessary, in Afghanistan and perhaps in Saudi Arabia again. My nervousness about that and the whole Blair commitment here is how much the Europeans can do and how much the Europeans should do. But the problem is, we have got instability in a large part of the world because traditional societies are going through all of these sets of transitions, and one therefore has to expect that their states will collapse, their societies will be unstable for some period. But we now live in a much more global world. How do we cope? European states and societies are going to have to cope with a lot of continuing immigrants. One of the paradoxes of Europe is that several European states believe that they are not states of immigration, but in the 1990s, more immigrants actually arrived within the European Union than arrived even within the United States. And that will continue. The Straits of Gibraltar are, after all, 15 kilometers wide, very easy to get across on a night on a motorboat. Similarly, the Straits of Sicily, similarly to move between Albania and Italy. Europe, therefore, can't disengage. It doesn't quite know how to engage. And that's the underlying dilemma for European governments. When I say containment, what the European governments are trying to think about in developing a European common foreign policy is, how do we help this process of nation building? In southeastern Europe, we've accepted that this implies a 20-year commitment in Albania, Macedonia, Bosnia and Kosovo in order to rebuild civil society and an effective non-corrupt state. In Sierra Leone, the British, with tacit support from the French and the Americans, have put a very small toe in. Could the Europeans take on much more? How much more can we help unstable societies like Afghanistan and Pakistan? We're not sure.
Thank you very much, William. I'm now going to call on Professor Chris Brown to finish this first round. The ethical issues are so enormous and wide-ranging that 7 minutes is almost an insult, but he's going to give us some reflections and initial reflections on this.
Actually, many of the things I want to say have been said before, but not by me, so I'll say them again. The international relations profession uses the term international order in a rather ambiguous way. We sometimes mean by that order in the sense of what are the underlying rules and Westphalian system or of the post-Westphalian system or whatever. We sometimes use order in the more commonsensical notion of, you know, how orderly things are at any one time. What I want to suggest, slightly contra mic, is that actually order in the first sense is not challenged. That I don't think the nature of the rules and norms of the international system have changed over the course of the last 6 weeks. What we have is a major problem of order in the second sense. That is to say, there is a serious police threat, if you like, to a number of states which will have to be coped with. So I think there's a lot of implications post 9/11, as people call it, changes in US political culture, alliance politics in the world, possibly challenges to multiculturalism in some countries. I doubt if there's a real challenge to the international order. The emerging post-Westphalian order will continue to emerge. Insofar as globalization meant anything on the 10th of September, it means much the same on the 12th of September. Probably, as it there may be a slightly darker tinge to globalization than there was before, slightly more of an orientation towards security than previously. Essentially, I don't think we're in a case of the West versus the rest, although occasional pictures might give that impression. I don't actually think we're in a war against terrorism. I don't have too much of a problem with the use of war as a metaphor. I mean, we use it all the time, trade wars, wars against drugs, wars against poverty. I think in some respects it's a slightly wrong metaphor in this case. I think a hunt rather than a war would be better. I think the analogy is possibly, the best analogy of the last few hundred years is maybe with piracy. That piracy was a threat to all countries. Those countries that harbored pirates were regarded as pirates themselves, and any civilized country was entitled to take action against pirates. It seems to me that's probably a better analogy than war. It still probably involves the use of violence, but how we defend violence is quite important, and the words we use are important in this context. Terrorism is too general. Sure, the events of 9/11 will have an impact. They've had an impact on the Irish situation. But we're not engaging in a hunt for pirates, including ETA or including the Tamil Tigers. There's a very specific problem here, a particular radical Islamic networks who are a real threat to a number of states. They're not actually a threat to the United States. They're a threat to US citizens and interests, but it's not the United States that will be overthrown if they were successful. It's many of the Gulf states. I think they have some wider implications, but the nature of these groups limits the threat. Doesn't make them easier to deal with, but it limits the threat. The real challenge, West and the rest, isn't there, because these groups are not based on a universal ethical doctrine. And this is where Mick's point about Che Guevara is absolutely relevant. Take it back 30 years. Consider the late 60s, early 70s. Then you had worldwide guerrilla campaigns. Vietnam, Palestine, Latin America, Africa. You had terrorist groups throughout the world, and they were linked. You had the Red Army faction, so-called Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. You had the Red Brigades in Italy. The IRA was becoming a red-green organization instead of simply a nationalist organization. Weathermen in the United States, you know, at the level of FAST, the Angry Brigade in this country. There was a certain level of cross-training. I mean, the Red Army faction Germans trained with Palestinians in Jordan and Lebanon, places like that. Behind these people, you had a wider ideology, a quasi-Marxist ideology of struggle, which linked to precisely the broader progressive movements that Mick was talking about. You had a situation where, even if people didn't approve of the tactic, they might have approved of the goal. Most people thought the Red Army faction in Germany were loonies, but the Red Army faction had some sensing. If you were on the left, you could see something about what they were getting at, even if you thought the tactic was all wrong. Now, of course, this never turned into a war against terrorism. It never turned into a global struggle for a variety of reasons, but it gives a point of reference for assessing the present situation. The present groups have very limited appeal, it seems to me, outside of the area of Islam. You get a certain kind of those people who regard global capitalism and America as the enemy might take a certain sense of satisfaction about the things that have happened, but they can't really say your struggle is our struggle. I mean, Harold Pinter, John Pilger, the usual suspects and so on, are not really looking at the Taliban and saying, yeah, you and I are on the same side. They're obviously not on the same side. And I think that limits, in many respects, the appeal of these groups. It makes the threat more manageable. Unfortunately, it also makes the situation more dangerous in some respects. The fact that these earlier groups, which used violence, were linked to this broader coalition, had two effects which I think are quite important, but which are missing in this case. Effect number one was it affected the tactics. If you claim to be part of a broad coalition of progressive forces in the world struggling against capitalism, then killing innocent civilians was not something that you could really boast about. Many of these groups had a very loose definition of what constituted a military target, but they still did try and draw distinctions between military and civilian targets. Clearly the present people do not. When spokesmen for the Al-Qaeda group say that Muslims should stay clear of towers and aircraft, they're sending a very clear message to people who are not Muslims. We don't care about you, is the message they're sending. Progressive politics also, the fact that there's a wider progressive alliance, linked in terrorists to political processes. It allowed for conversion processes to take place. It allowed for somebody like Gerry Adams to move from being a terrorist to being somebody who was a peacemaker. It allowed Yasser Arafat from being a terrorist to being somebody who I still would regard as a peacemaker, although there's ambiguities about that. One, if you are committed to some kind of wider progressive goals, then the way in which you define your tactics allows the process of being brought into politics. Now, I think it's very unlikely we can see this. We can have lots of arguments about what the future of Israel might be, for example, how much support. Personally, my view would be to give as much support as possible to the two-state solution and to press for an independent Palestinian state in the Middle East. None of this has got anything to do with Osama bin Laden and the Taliban. They don't want that solution. They want to destroy Israel, and it seems to me no West European countries or North American countries can accept that as a remotely progressivist aim. So I think there's a genuine problem here. With tough times ahead against a ruthless enemy, compromise is not going to be easy to find, not because we're not prepared to compromise, but because I don't think they are, because the attack that they're making is not against the worst of us, it's against, if you like, the best of us. How do we handle this situation? I think remember basics. Get back to basics. There's no quick fix. There's never a quick fix for anything. Violence is always a bad thing, but it's sometimes the least worst option. When we do resort to violence, though, we need to have a clear sense of what the outcomes ought to be. I think the jury is out on that one at the moment. For the time being, I would be prepared to support what is happening, but obviously one wants to see some sense that this is not just bombing for the sake of bombing. Biggest question of all, though, final point, Chris, don't abandon other projects. Continue to push for justice for Palestinians, not because it will please the Taliban, because it won't. The definition of justice is, but because it's the right thing to do. Don't lose the agenda of global justice that Mick was talking about. Don't lose that sense of because of this. Try and keep in mind that there are more things going on in the world than this particular campaign. Fight the campaign, be prepared to take tough decisions, but don't lose the other values as well. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure Chris won't mind my saying that that applause was not just for him, but for all of them on the panel. Thanks very much. On second thoughts, I thought he might object. We've got technically just over 20 minutes left, but I know my colleagues can stay for a few minutes after 6:30 if you can, and if there are questions. It's going to be a bit difficult for me to manage this, partly because I'm being blinded by these lights here. It seems to me sensible, looking at the proportion of numbers, to take sort of two questions from downstairs for every one in the balcony. I may have to do this in order to see you. I think also I'm going to simply take questions addressed to an individual member of the panel, or at least I'm only going to allow one member of the panel to answer each particular question, otherwise we'll be here all night. So if you've got a question, would you put up your hand and try and keep the question or the comment brief, because you make your point much better and you stop people being bored. There's a hand right at the back. There's a mic roving around, I think, upstairs and downstairs.
Hello. Basically, the first
hold,
thing...
Hold the mic up to you.
The first thing I want to say is I'm against what happened on the 11th of September. However, I got this question... more of a globalized politics of the United States rather than only a specific thing that happened on the 11th of September. My question is, if you cannot prevent acts like the 11th of September, if you cannot apply a security policy within your own country, what makes you think that you will be able to implement a world order policy? Meaning, how can you implement a peacekeeping policy? For example, in Yugoslavia, or implement a policy, an anti-terrorist policy, when you don't know who's your enemy anymore?
Right. Thanks very much. Did you hear that up the top? Yep. Okay. Right. I think I'm going to ask Jamie Rubin to answer that.
I think I will take this question to put a little bit of what you've heard in context. We do know who the enemy is, and we know where more or less they're located. The bombing campaign is not something that anybody does with any pleasure. I think the least worst option is a pretty good way of describing it. Let's remember, prior to September 11th, what Afghanistan looked like. It was probably, with the exception of North Korea, the most odious regime in the world, and many of the people who are criticizing U.S. military action were screaming as loud as they could, "Why don't you do something about the Taliban?" This was a government that was told by the Clinton administration on 10 separate occasions that if Osama bin Laden commits another act of terrorism against U.S. people or property, we will hold you responsible. They were provided the substance and details of the indictment of his co-conspirators in the 1998 bombings. The evidence was provided to the Taliban, and they chose, for whatever reason, to avoid that situation. We know what the objectives are. They may not fit with some people's desires. There are two tracks here. One track is how do you get at those responsible for September 11th and try to make sure they don't do it again? That's what's going on in Afghanistan and through a number of law enforcement measures around the world.
to destroy this organization and to destroy the regime that allowed them to operate there. There is a larger, as you put it, metaphoric war on terrorism, and that is to try to stop all state sponsorship of terrorism going forward. And that is something that is broader. It's basically political, economic, and otherwise. But on this operation, we know who's responsible, and we more or less know where the individuals are, and we're going to find them. And if there are civilians who lose their lives in the meantime, it's not because the United States chose to have itself bombed on September 11th and get those responsible. It's because the Taliban cared so little about their population, so little that they kicked out all of the UN and other humanitarian workers who were trying to feed their people and brought this on themselves.
Thank you, Jamie. Right, I'm going to... As the guy in the light-colored shirt there, yep.
Upstairs.
I suppose, I'll come back to you.
This would be directed at Professor Brown more than anyone else. I'd have to disagree with him that there is perhaps nothing much to be said about the implications of the current crisis for international order in terms of the normative question, international order as a system of norms and interests between states. It's a bit regrettable that, given the topic of the discussion this evening, that there's really hardly anything being said about what the implications of the current situation are for international law or for established treaty-based systems for dealing with threats to international security. I wonder whether the current coalition against terrorism is, in fact, a next step on a road that we've already been on since at least Kosovo, where the United States, in particular, takes an approach to international security that is somewhat a la carte, rather than using established processes to deal with a complex problem. It goes around the established mechanisms, the Security Council, for example, in order to build a coalition and to mobilize through its many bilateral relations a coalition around a specific interest. I wonder comment just on the implications of this for international order. If at one time we thought that threats to international security would be dealt with through multilateral channels, normative channels, rather than through ad hoc coalitions where the approach to security gets a bit out of whack in terms of the balance between order and justice. Thanks.
Thank you. Chris Brown.
Yeah, I think I can see where that question's coming from, one sees the point behind it. I think the trouble with trying to turn this into a legal problem rather than ultimately a security problem is that the international community currently does not possess either an international court that can handle this, nor does it possess an international police force. As far as the International Criminal Court, I mean, the people will immediately make the point that the United States is one of the few countries that's refused to sign this. But of course, the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute of 98, does not cover terrorism. It doesn't cover terrorism because nobody could agree what a terrorist was. I think there is no body of international law, there is no court, but more important, bringing this to the United Nations, it seems to me, is a way of kicking the whole thing into touch. It's not a way of dealing with the problem. The only way the terrorists in question are going to be dealt with is by a coalition of states led by the US actually handling this. Now, it seems to be quite plausible that in the course of the next week or two, a resolution will pass the Security Council. Given the nature of the coalition at the moment, I see no reason why it wouldn't. The five permanent members would be on board for that. But I don't think, frankly, that's going to make much difference when it does.
There's a question down here at the front. Resolution 1273. Is there a mic? It's coming.
Coming. It's here.
Very quickly, John McCain wrote today that the United States should hit them harder, in his words, Afghanistan. And essentially his argument, I don't think, has been much different from the argument of those who want to hit them softer, which is simply the end is to eradicate terrorism. So if we lose innocent civilians along the way, it doesn't matter. But the problem seems to be that Bin Laden seems to think the end
is good, and therefore the means don't matter much. And are we not, by taking such action, simply saying that, basically confirming what people had said about the United States in the past? Francis Botha of South Africa once said in response to an uprising that this uprising will bring out the best in us. And does this not seem to be reason enough to stop this war?
Thank you. Margaret, do you wish to comment on that?
My problem with any advice to hit them harder is my doubt that we're hitting them at all. And therefore, if the advice is to hit them harder, I saw this remark that somebody said that they should bomb Afghanistan into the Stone Age, and the comment was somebody seemed not to have noticed that it had already been bombed into the Stone Age. So I don't see this as a reasonable aim, and I don't see it as something that can actually achieve the goal of either getting bin Laden or destroying terrorism.
Right. Now, you're going to have to be patient with me. There are lots of hands. There's a guy at the back who I got wrong last time, so there's a mic up there. Then I'd better... Is there anyone up at the top there? Okay, you next.
Yeah, I will ask a short question. I just wanted to ask to you, the justification, the war on terrorism in Afghanistan, the war has been justified by the fact that the attack on the 11th of September was an attack against the Western civilization, against US and Western freedom. Now, do you think this is true, or do you think that the attack on the 11th of September were mostly an attack on against US foreign policy in the Middle East? In other words, do you think bin Laden wants to destroy the US and to destroy the Western society, or rather to destroy Israel and to get rid of the US in the Middle East?
Right, thanks.
You.
I think Dr. Della Cura might have an interesting view on that.
It is very difficult to know what bin Laden wants. We don't know. This is the honest answer. It is, I suppose, referring to the first part of the question, an attack on the Western way of life, the values that the West, supposedly just the West, and it's not just the West in my view, stands for. But it's a very negative, I couldn't even call it ideology, stance, which is anti-American more than anything else. It has to do with power politics. And it has to do with a refusal to accept or respect a certain way of life. But beyond that, we don't know very much about the intentions of this organization. We don't have the information. This is the honest answer. I think that it's important to emphasize in this context that, and this goes for the examples of the various countries that I mentioned when I talked about this, Algeria, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, that until September the 11th, for the most part, the casualties of Islamist violence have been Muslims themselves. We have a figure of up to 100,000 lost in the war in Algeria since 1992. 100,000, up to 100,000, this is a lot of people. And it's easy to forget that it's mostly Muslims who have suffered in this confrontation up to now. And it is against the way of life of many Muslims that this whole organization has targeted. Traveling in the Middle East sometimes, it's revealing that people, ordinary people of the various countries, are horrified at the various terrorist attacks that have been perpetrated in the name of Islam at various points in history. And this is just a very ordinary Muslim response.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Question down here, blue shirt, please. Mike.
How do you know his name? Is that his name?
It might be.
This is a question for Jamie Rubin. You spoke about the nation building embarked on by President Bush. And that seems unrealistic at best, because on the one hand, you have a British Prime Minister who is reluctant to pump more money into his NHS, and an American president who wanted to hand his tax surplus back to his country's millionaires. And if you do embark on nation building, you're going to have to rebuild the whole of the Islamic world. So how do you propose you're actually going to go about doing it?
Well, you're certainly correct that both President Bush and Prime Minister Blair have domestic priorities of their own. What I'm suggesting is that prior to September 11th, the word nation building was anathema to this president, that he's looked at the situation, and one of the reasons why I think he's getting so much support in the United States is because people have realized that the goal in Afghanistan after destroying the Al-Qaeda organization, in order to minimize resentment that will be there in the course of this campaign, is to be able to have people look back and say that the people of Afghanistan are living a better life than they would have prior to September 11th. And let's remember what that life was. Women having no rights whatsoever, the Taliban throwing out humanitarian organizations that were trying to provide food and medicine to the people there, no political or economic future. A stone age was the word that they were living prior to September 11th. What President Bush has correctly, with I think some advice from the Blair government, realized is that after we're done with destroying the Al-Qaeda organization, we want to have created a better Afghanistan, because there are going to be a lot of people in the Muslim world and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan who are going to be very angry at the United States and Britain for what they had to do to destroy the terrorists who, if they didn't do that, would commit another act potentially worse than September 11th. And so they've come up with what I think is a wise policy, which is to basically flip-flop on nation building, to offer the reconstruction and rehabilitation assistance that is necessary in Afghanistan, to ask the UN to play a political role, and to be prepared to provide billions of dollars over time in foreign assistance to Afghanistan. I think the United States is going to do that. They already have upped their number to $500 million in humanitarian aid, and I think European countries and Middle Eastern countries and Asian countries are going to be enlisted in a worldwide effort to make Afghanistan a better place than it was on September 10th.
Now I'm going to take two questions together and see how that goes. This chap in the middle there, and lady on the right in white. So, can we have the mic please come down this side?
Thank you.
No, I didn't ask you, I'm sorry. I said this chap here, who's standing up in the middle. Now, I'll try to come back to you, okay? Sorry, just hurry up a bit. I know you're unpaid, but...
If you want to fight against Bin Laden, it is important to see who created Bin Laden. Who sent Bin Laden to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets? Who gave arms, money to Bin Laden? Which was the powers that supported the Taliban?
Is this a question to a specific person?
Yes, I would like to ask to the U.S. representative.
I'm very, very happy to take your question, but I'm not going to let you make a speech, all right?
Right. So I'm making the question. So
there's three I have already.
Wait, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Who put the Taliban in power? It was not Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, with the support of the USA. And now the USA wants to replace the Taliban with another regime based in the Northern Alliance. But the Northern Alliance was not the first people that supported Bin Laden, was not the first people that put problems with women, was not the people that have linked with the narco traffic and the opium in Afghanistan.
Right.
So don't you think that all what the U.S. is doing now in Afghanistan is to create more and more problems, more and more terrorists, and nothing will happen after that.
That's all my question.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Professor Cox her first crack at that, but I think Leslie Vindemore is it? Please, we've got one more. It's a poison chalice, but
I even know the speaker. Isaac.
Well, that helps. Right. Have we got a mic? Have we got a mic down here, please?
Yeah, I mean,
we're just making.
Oh, sorry. I've been quiet for 20 minutes.
I know, bursting to participate, but it's not very technical, is it? A microphone?
Leslie, just talk into it.
Just.
I have a question that's sort of directed at the three panelists on the right, but probably the response is mostly for, I'm sorry, Dr.
Dalla-Cura.
Exactly. Responding to Jamie Rubin's comments, I think you're absolutely right that at least in the short term, public opinion in the United States is fully on side of the military intervention in Afghanistan, and probably for the long term, or at least for the short long term, it will remain that way. I think that the question that's interesting is that which has arisen in the last few days in the opinion pages of the major Western newspapers, which is the comment that the United States is currently losing the war of ideas. And this comment's been made by people like Richard Holbrooke, by academics like Shibley Talhami. And I'm curious what it means to, first of all, whether it your perception. And I think when this comment is made, it's made really that we're losing this war amongst public opinion in the Middle East and amongst moderate regimes in the Arab and Islamic world. I'm curious whether you think this is the case, what it means to win the war of ideas, whether this would have made a difference for Professor Light.
I think we got the point.
Okay.
And Mick Cox on the first question about the Americans' responsibility.
Well, it's a sort of obvious point, Isaac, isn't it? Much of this, take that or leave it. I mean, it's an obvious point. I mean, you know, that this is
true.
This is a legacy of the Cold War. It is a legacy of particular means of fighting the Cold War, which we are now living with. And if it reminds us of anything, then it is that there are always consequences of what you're doing. And there will obviously be consequences, too, of the way this war is conducted, the numbers of civilian casualties in this, and the consequences we're going to live with. So you always live with consequences. And it seems to me, therefore, we're living within the consequences of all this. On the other hand, I mean, we do have to ask ourselves a question as well. Is it, you know, in the end, three planes ploughed into three buildings, the fourth one was brought down. These were simple, straight acts of terrorism. You know, and if one wants to actually, by the way, quote a progressive on this, Isaac, let's quote Leon Trotsky, you know, who had some very powerful things to say against terrorism. Now, Trotsky, like any Marxist, would analyze the origins of where that terrorism came from, of course. But he'd still say it was terrorism. You know, and this is not the way forward. But, you know, we can analyze things forever and ever and ever about origins. We can analyze the origins of Hitler and find it back in the Versailles Peace Treaty in 1919. That doesn't actually address the question of what Hitler was. And in the same way, you know, analyzing the origins of where bin Laden comes from, or the phenomenon of bin Ladenism, frankly, it strikes me, I'll be blunt about it, strikes me as a clerical fascist. This totalitarian, you know, represents a serious question, a serious problem. And I just don't think we address the issue, frankly, by simply retreating into origins, where this all began. We are here now in 2001. We may have some major criticisms to make of the US policy on this. I agree. No question about that. But simply to retreat into origins without actually talking about what we're talking about here doesn't help us define this particular phenomenon.
I think prepare. I think Professor Light has been moving around because she sees the link as being the lessons of past activity. But I'm going to ask Dr. Dalla-Cura to speak quickly, and then Margaret, you can butt in.
I don't think we can talk about a war of ideas. This is not a war about ideas. And the point I was trying to make before is that there's nothing positive or nothing of substance that is tangible that has been proposed by the bin Laden side that one can talk about in this sense of a war of ideas. I think this is a case of real policies, and this whole business is, I think, partly about American policies
in the Middle East, not just American, but other Western policies in the Middle East. I'm not saying that the West can make or break the various regimes in the Middle East. I think this is not the case. But I think that there have been some misguided decisions that have to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also in the Gulf, the whole policy of dual containment, sanctions against Iran and Iraq. The balance of power game in the Gulf, I think, is very, very problematic and needs to be thought through again. It is such real issues, I think, on the part of the US and other Western actors that need to be addressed. And these are the real issues, not ideas, because I think this is not the point at the moment.
Thank you. Margot, you've got a minute's credit from your previous conciseness. So.
The question of origins is relevant in the sense that if you take actions now that are the origins of the next great act of terrorism, that matters. And that, I think, is what the question was.
Right. Thanks. There was the chap at the back who I wrongly took the mic from, so could we have one to him again? And then I'm going to go back to the balcony. And I think then we'll be drawing near to the end.
Thank you.
I can see people waving at me, yeah. It's okay.
They're not waving, they're throwing things at
me. Please, keep it quick, if you can.
Thank you. Just a couple of points. I'm a student of international relations here and probably the only Afghan citizen. First of all, this question to Mr. Rubens. The Afghans gave 1.5 million lives fighting, if not just a jihad, fighting for capitalism in a sense. And what did they get at the end of that? What was the American reward for those 1.5 million lives that were given? Secondly, a point mentioned by Professor Dr. Dalakura.
Everybody knows
sorry.
It
now. Sorry. For example, you mentioned 100,000 people dying in Algeria. Where was the American government or the European governments? Why couldn't they use their influence on the French government's support for the military dictatorship in Algeria? The Muslims or the party did win a democratic election, and yet they were kept out of power. What happened on September the 11th cannot be justified in any sense, but I do agree origins are the most important thing. The question of why is the most important thing. Someone mentioning the towers were near to the Statue of Liberty. Why wasn't the Statue of Liberty hit when it was a hit against freedom? It was not. It was a hit against American foreign policy. It was not justified in any sense or in any way, but it was born due to the inconsistencies of the American foreign policy for the last half century.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Jamie Rubin to give the answer if he can quickly, and then I want to bring William Wallace in, on, especially on the Europeans in Algeria, which is a special area of responsibility, and then perhaps Professor Brown briefly.
Okay. Like the question before you, the issue has been raised of who was bin Laden, where did he come from, what did the United States do in 1979? Let me answer these as honestly as I can. The lives that were given up by the Afghan people in their brave repelling of the Soviet Union were not for us. They were for themselves. They committed the Soviet Union invaded their country, and they were prepared to fight for their country against the Soviet Union. Did they do the world a service by helping to create one of the conditions that might have contributed to the end of communism? Yes. Were they given the support they should have received after that time? No. It's as simple as that. But Mick put this as well as it can be put. When the European powers made mistakes after World War I that historians believe spawned Hitler's Germany, and there was a debate in this parliament here in this country about whether or not Britain should go to war against Hitler, did they spend all their time thinking about the mistakes they made 25 years before, or did they say that there are some terrible people out there who are prepared to commit mass murder, and are we going to do anything about it? And so, yes, your country has suffered. Your people have suffered. More should have been done. I dare say that some of your leaders have been less than wonderful people as well. The leaders who were prepared to bomb each other and destroy the country perhaps even more completely than the Soviet Union destroyed it out of their desire to gain power in factional fighting around Kabul. And those people deserve more blame for what happened in Afghanistan than the United States. Those were decisions that were made by leaders in your country. And if you want to always find the outside power to blame for all the world's problems, we're here, the United States gets the blame, I'm used to it. But I think it's worth people remembering that there are multiple reasons for these events. Yep. And in point of fact, the Osama bin Laden fundraised for himself and went to Afghanistan and had no contact with the Central Intelligence
Agency. Right. Thank you. William Wallace.
Rapidly, just to repeat what Jamie has said, no one up here wants to say everything that Western governments have done in the last 50 years has been right, although the sweeping statement that what the United States has done over the last half century is all wrong seems to me a bit strong. I was saying in a lecture yesterday, you know, if you imagine an international order which had been designed in 1945 by the Soviet Union or by victorious Nazi Germany, it might not have been quite as half-decent as the one we've got now. The United States has made mistakes. The French government clearly made mistakes on the Algerian situation post that election, partly because there were plenty of people in France who were scared that a revolution in Algeria would immediately spill over into France. What happens in Algeria does immediately spill over into France, just as the British government is not unaffected at the present moment by fear that a collapse of the regime in Pakistan would immediately spill over into British cities and British streets. Part of the European reaction to all of this is the recognition that we can't disentangle ourselves. We are unavoidably engaged. Nobody's mentioned Kashmir, but I'm conscious, having done a lot of my politics in Bradford and Manchester, that Kashmir is an issue in the city politics of a large number of British cities, and one of the things which the British government needs to cope with in untangling the consequences of this crisis, to which the Kashmiri situation is very clearly linked, is sorting out our relations with India and Pakistan and with the large number of foreign Islamists who are involved in the Kashmiri situation and how that feeds back into British domestic politics. So we're all committed. None of us always make the right solutions, of course, but managing all of the strains of coping with the romantic reaction, which is really what the Islamic fundamentalism is that we're facing, is going to be a very difficult long haul.
Thank you very much. Chris Brown, briefly.
Very briefly on origins. One of the first principles of international relations is that you can't break eggs without making an omelette. Whatever you do in any one moment is going to have a consequence later on. We try and handle problems as they come up, but we have to accept that the consequences of handling a problem today is probably going to be another problem tomorrow. That is true if we use violence in these circumstances, the war in Afghanistan, but it's also true if we don't use violence. Whatever we do is going to have consequences. Tracing through what those consequences are is an interesting thing for academics to do, but the idea that we can explain what ought to be done now on the basis of origins and what was done 10 years ago seems to me a fantasy.
Thank you very much. Jamie Rubin has to leave now, so I'd like on your behalf to thank him very much for his participation. I'm
very good.
I'm going to take, with my colleague's permission, two more questions, and I think we're running out of steam. There's one gentleman in the box there, and then one here, and then that'll be it. Oh, let's take these two together, we'll answer them, and then we'll draw things to a halt.
Okay, thank you. Jamie Rubin's last point, we've got to nail this one once and for all. This situation is not comparable in any way with the Second World War. the Second World War was a war against a state with a specific ideology. We knew their aims, and as one of the panelists said, we also would know when we had won. This is a very different situation, and it concerns me greatly that a senior United States representative doesn't see it in a different way, and also is not prepared to learn from European states about the way that terrorism might best be dealt with. Secondly, as a Muslim and a socialist, I'd just like to make a point to Dr. Della Cora. I'm just concerned that you asked the very first question, is there something special in Islam that leaves it open to this type of abuse? And you said yes and no. And I'm really concerned that Islam as an ideology is isolated by you. We could also say yes and no about capitalism as an ideology, and that is also grossly abused, as we've seen throughout history. There are numerous examples, tragically, with even more deaths than we saw on September 11th.
Thank you very much. The last question was here. It has already got the mic.
I may be doing them an injustice, but I got the feeling that with Professor Brown, Professor Wallace, and to an extent James Rubin, that there was a sort of just war theory there, in that the use of force is abhorrent, but there are circumstances in which it can be justified. Yeah. Now, I'm a bit concerned in this case, because just war theory works fine when you're talking about state actors, but it's very hard to be discriminate, proportional, or have chances of success, which are key criteria of just war theory, when you're dealing with non-state actors. So I think I have to agree with Marlowe Knight. I don't understand what the objective is of the continued bombing, because it's so difficult to abide by these criteria. You run the danger, as Professor Light said, of just worsening the situation, creating more terrorists and exacerbating the problem. I just wonder if they'd like to comment. Maybe I'm doing them an injustice. Maybe they're not coming from that point at all.
Thank you very much. I think the best way of finishing would be to give everybody a quick word. They can decide which question to answer or whether they want to say anything else. Obviously, we've got to be brief. But starting with Katharina, please.
The point I was trying to make was that in Islam, as in every other religion, there are elements that can be used in a particularly nasty way. That was all I was saying, and I cannot deny, in all honesty, that these elements are there in Islam. But my point was that it doesn't have to be like this, this is why I gave all the examples of how it has not been used in this way. And my point also was that if we're seeking answers to the question of what happened, why did it happen, and what's going to happen in the future with regards to this phenomenon of this extremist interpretation of Islam, we have to look at the real politics of the region and not simply to the Quran or to the principles of the religion. That was my point. Thank you.
Thank you. You want to pass?
Yeah.
Right. Mike Nichols.
Well, I haven't really much more to say than what I've already said, really. I mean,
well, that is all right, then. You don't have to.
Well, I do. I'm in close, it's okay, but I'm just winding myself up here for a three-hour peroration. I suppose, broadly speaking, what I'm trying to do is speak to the large left, which exists, I mean, in spite of the end of history and all the rest of it. And what I'm concerned about is some large part of the left's response to this. That is really in what I'm really trying to drive at. That, you know, as we've seen even here this evening, I mean, all the problems, you know, derive from the United States. I mean, all the fundamental issues of the world can be brought back to the problems of the United States. And imperialism is the greatest problem. Frankly, I brought up in a whole generation too, where we had a large left once upon a time, many, many years ago, many of whom were apologists for the Soviet Union. And even then, we didn't want to talk about the Soviet Union and its problems. And if we did, you know, it was imperialism in the United States was the main problem. That was always the way it was formulated. And I think we're seeing that same type of way of thinking about this issue again, that we're focusing in on the United States rather than actually looking at where this has come from. I didn't say we shouldn't talk about origin. I said where we are at now. You know, it's a great evasion. It is a great evasion to find it is the United States which is the source of all problems. When it promotes democracy, it is imperialist. When it doesn't promote democracy, it's an imperialist. If it promotes human rights, it's imperialist. If it doesn't promote human rights, it's imperialist. You know, there is a sort of sense in which there's a great evasion on this political issue by the left, which I think really has got to get some of its house in order on this. I'd actually talk about what has actually caused
what the consequences are and what this phenomenon represents within the Middle East and particularly within Afghanistan. And I suppose that is, I find, the real depressing aspect about much of this, that the left is refusing that type of engagement with that type of debate about that particular, and making the whole issue one of the United States all the time.
Thank you very much, Mick. Chris, do you want to address the just war point or some other as well?
I think the just war does provide a set of categories for thinking about the application of violence in international relations and in other areas of social life, because just war thinking didn't actually originate in international relations. It originated in a much wider conception of what the role of violence was in human existence. I think it gives us the right kind of questions. It allows us to make judgments, and it gives us the terms under which those judgments are made. What it doesn't operate as is a kind of checklist where you put a tick in a box here. You have to think about the issues. You have to say to yourself, is this particular activity consistent with the kind of criteria which we regard as morally desirable? I think just war can be very useful. It tells us, for example, why flying aircraft with civilians on them into the World Trade Center isn't an appropriate way of protesting against American foreign policy. You can use just war criteria, I think, fairly clearly to get to that point. It also invites us to ask very hard questions about the application of bombing in Afghanistan. But I don't think it gives us an answer to those questions. What it says to us is that this activity is justified if and only if it is can be linked to a solution to the crisis. Now, whether it can actually be linked to a solution of the crisis is a matter for political judgment. It's a matter for political, strategic, diplomatic judgment, on which opinions differ, as we have seen around this table tonight. So I think just war is offering the right questions, but just war theory as such doesn't offer answers. For that, you need to exercise political, economic, strategic, military judgments.
Thank you. William.
Two points. First, I'm a Christian. I belong to a religion which has been responsible for the deaths of millions of people over the last 2,000 years. Aberrations of Christianity can be blamed for some pretty disgusting things, ranging from the Crusades to the origins of the anti-Semitism which Hitler picked up from the worst aspects of Habsburg Counter-Reformation Catholicism. I'm happy to say that, by and large, even the Catholic Church has now reached a stage of recognizing that liberalism is part of religion and that the separation of religion from the state is a necessary part of modernity. Many people within Islam have reached the same point now, but a number have not. Fundamentalism is the problem, not different religions. And Christian fundamentalism is as much a problem, sadly, still in parts of the United States, as other forms of fundamentalism are as well. So that's one very major point, and we have to hold to that. We are against fundamentalism, secular or religious, Christian, Muslim or Jewish, and we are defending liberal principles and the liberal society. And that leads me on to the just war point. I actually think I agree strongly. The bombing campaign, you don't bomb if you don't know what your targets are. That's what the senior British Marine, after all, was saying and got in trouble on the Today programme. You know, don't send my troops into Afghanistan if you don't know what you want us to hit with what, for what purposes. So immediately, the war is not what one needs. That's why I use the term containment. We have to contain this social reaction against modernity in a very illiberal way, which is what we're facing in a range of these countries. It's worth going back and rereading the famous George Kennan article on containment of 1947, because what he was saying was Soviet communism is actually an anti-Western, anti-liberal disease of a reaction against modernity. We've got to hold this in check. It's not a war, it's a long-term conflict. We have to hold to our principles, and if we hang on long enough, they'll live through it. That's the sort of containment which Western liberal societies have got to use against this terrorist threat. It means living with a degree of risk which the United States hasn't been used to yet. Western European societies have got used to living with that level of risk. It's not very comfortable, not very pleasant, but that's what modern international politics is about.
Thank you very much, William. I'm going to draw things to a close now. I'd like to thank all of you for staying the course. By definition, you're still here, and not everybody is. Thank you very much for your interest and your patience. I'd particularly like to thank my colleagues on the panel. I'm not going to name them again. You know who they are. We have inevitably only scratched the surface of some extremely complex events, but I hope we have left you with some further thoughts other than those which you had when you came in the room. That's all one can ask. I've been personally frustrated not being able to have my say. I hope that there might be another occasion. Well, in a way, I don't. I would like the war to end and some sort of peaceful order to be restored, but I'm afraid I doubt it in the near future and that there will have to be other occasions of this kind in which perhaps I will be able to make some comment. But anyway, thank you once again to all my colleagues and to you.